Hi, welcome to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing. It is Wednesday, April 3rd, and I'm Jessica Steinberg. I'm speaking today with political correspondent Sam Sokol and environmental reporter Sue Sirks. Hello, good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Hi there. It is day 180 of the war. IDF chief Herzi Halevi issued an apology after midnight Wednesday for the strike on an aid convoy in Gaza, when three cars from the World Central Kitchen convoy were targeted by drone-fired missiles, leaving seven humanitarian workers dead. Obviously, we'll keep on following that story on the top of the Times Visual page. It was also the third night of the four-day protest in Jerusalem as protesters called on the Knesset to not take their long-planned Passover break. During the evening's protests, protesters turned violent, breaking through barriers in front of the prime minister's house. Government figures, including National Unity Party head Benny Gantz and Shin Bet chief Ronen Bar, warned protesters against violence, called it a worrying trend, and asked people to stay calm. There is also the heated rhetoric and protests about the interim ruling on the ultra-Orthodox draft, something that we'll talk about. A state comptroller's report about the government's successive government's lack of action on climate change, and cocoa plants that survived October 7th. Those are some of the other headlines that we'll be discussing this morning, all in today's podcast. And we're going to talk about it after a quick break.
The Technion Israel Institute of Technology is where some of Israel's brightest minds ask the biggest question of all. What if? What if they could take on the world's biggest challenges? What if they could develop life-changing environmental, scientific, health, medical, and technological discoveries that will make a huge impact on Israel and the planet? But they don't just ask the question, they answer it too. They turn those ideas into reality. They make them happen. To see just some of the incredible things they've achieved, get the Technion Booklet of Wonders at ats.org/wonders. We hope it inspires you to give them your support so they can keep doing what they do best. The American Technion Society. World-changing discoveries by Israel's brightest minds, made possible by you.
Okay, Sam, maybe let's just take a first look at the protest, which you're going to be covering today in front of the Knesset, which I covered on Monday night, you covered on Sunday night, the first night of the protests. Thoughts about what we might be seeing? As I said, the plan, there is no protest tonight in the evening, which is when things tend to get a little bit more heated, or a lot more heated. Any thoughts about what might be happening today?
Well, look, the protests have been put together by an entire wide spectrum of groups, an entire coalition. It's not like there's one guiding force. And I think that it's quite possible that even though the official events are ending today, it's really hard to say what will happen tonight because people are angry and there are some groups that are more activists, some groups that are less. And it's quite possible that we might see a repeat of some of what happened yesterday. It's impossible to know, but I think that it's important to keep an eye out on this and in case it does escalate again.
Right. I mean, I know that when I was there, which was on Monday night, it was pretty calm, about an hour and a half of speeches. This big tent city that was set up really right outside the Knesset on Kaplan Street. And you had lots of different kinds of ages of people who were out there. You had a lot of the middle-aged and older protesters. You also had families. I saw a family of five setting up a tent for that night. Kids were coloring on pages outside of the tent. And you also had a lot of students. I know that last night's protest, as we all know, got much, much more heated as they marched toward Netanyahu's house, as they talked about marching to the president's residence, which I don't think ended up happening. But today's protests are basically taking place during the day with no speeches planned for the evening. and therefore presumably no permits that have been given to these protests for tonight, for Wednesday night.
Well, as we've seen in yesterday's protests and the entire year of protests leading up to October 7th in Tel Aviv against the judicial overhaul, even if the vast majority of protesters are in the designated areas and leave when they should be, you do have people who try to block roads, who will try to march on the homes of lawmakers or members of the government. So it's quite possible it'll happen again.
Okay. All right. Well, you're already in place. I know you're in the Knesset as we speak. So
as we speak.
Let's switch gears a little bit and talk about what you have been focusing a lot on this week and the last few weeks, which is the Haredi draft, the ultra-Orthodox draft. You wrote an explainer earlier in the week. You also interviewed United Torah Judaism's Haredi Knesset member Moshe Roth about the ruling. And what was really fascinating in your piece is that he looks at it primarily as a financial issue and one that he believes Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu will find some kind of last-minute Band-Aid that will at least take them another 5 or 6 months so that it won't be something that is bearing down on the ultra-Orthodox community right now. What I wanted to start with was to ask you, what were his thoughts about the concept in general? In other words, he's just not worried about ultra-Orthodox yeshiva students being drafted? Is that not something that he even really considers as a possibility?
So I think it's important first just to lay very briefly a little bit of groundwork here, which is that the court ruling was an interim ruling. The court's going to be sitting again in May. And the interim ruling essentially said, because there is no legal basis for the deferrals for these yeshiva students anymore, and they are subject to the draft, the yeshivas can't be funded based on the number of students who are sitting there if these students are learning illegally because they are supposed to be in the army. Now, the cut in these budgets overall is not going to decimate the so-called Olam HaTorah, the yeshiva world. But for some yeshivas, it will be absolutely devastating. And the response, at least in terms of political rhetoric, has been apocalyptic. Haredi political leaders have accused the court of waging a war to exterminate Torah study, of seeking to financially penalize the learning of Torah. But by the same token, the spiritual leaders of the Haredi world, the ones who instruct the Haredi politicians, have essentially laid down the following instruction, which is stay in the government for now. Right now, it is a financial penalty, and it leaving the government now would not help. It could make things worse. The red line for the Haredi parties is if and when the police and the army start arresting yeshiva students for dodging the draft or dragging them off to be forcibly inducted. And that is not something that anyone expects, because there simply isn't the logistical capacity to do that or to handle the massive protests or riots that this would spark. These yeshiva students are now eligible for the draft, but what is widely expected will happen is rather than, well, first of all, you have to understand that it takes time to send out draft notices. It's a process. It's not something that happens overnight, but even if this process starts immediately, what's going to happen is not that they're going to start dragging them out of the yeshivas, but what will happen is if a student is found to be a draft dodger, that will cut the budget to their yeshivas. They will be ineligible for certain benefits. Their travel abroad will be restricted. And if they try to travel abroad, or if they are found guilty of any other criminal offense, let's say they rear-end a car, or they shoplift, or do any sort of even minor crime, then suddenly the law enforcement will come down on like a ton of bricks and arrest them. So the feeling is more that rather than a forcible enlistment, they're going to try to use carrots and sticks, different types of financial incentives and penalties to to compel them over time. Even the most ardent advocates for Haredi enlistment, like Lapid and Lieberman, have said that this is not an option. I believe the phrase that Lapid used at one point was, we're not going to see tanks on the streets of Bnei Brak, the overwhelmingly Haredi city near Tel Aviv. And that's essentially what Roth told me as well, which is the next hearing in the court is in May. And even if that's the final hearing, it could take months potentially to have a ruling. This is such a contentious and complicated issue. So he believes that Netanyahu has several months to come up with some sort of creative solution. And Netanyahu reportedly, according to Hebrew media, reportedly has promised the ultra-Orthodox that he would try to bring a private bill to the Knesset following the upcoming recess to regulate the issue. The reason he would do that, if he this is indeed correct, is because he has been so far unable to come up with any sort of government bill regulating their status that would pass muster with the Attorney General or with his own coalition. But we can see that Netanyahu is frantically trying to keep the ultra-Orthodox on board because they are necessary for his coalition and his political future. They've been staunch allies of his for the past decade. And we can see the Haredim saying, let's give Netanyahu a chance. Let's see what he can do. Staying in right now will lose a lot less than if we immediately jump ship.
Mm-hmm. So basically, so we're in a holding pattern for the moment with this, even though obviously in terms of the rhetoric out there and what's happening on the streets sometimes feels like it's a lot more immediate, shall we say.
Despite heated efforts by members of both the opposition and the coalition to cancel the upcoming Knesset recess, the argument being if the hostages and the soldiers don't get a recess, why do lawmakers get a recess? The government did approve the upcoming recess, and it's, you know, going to be impossible to pass any sort of legislation on this or take any significant steps from the legislative side for more than a month. So I think we really are in a holding pattern. The Attorney General has instructed the education and defense ministries to begin preparations for the enlistment of the Haredim. But as I said, this is not an overnight thing. So yeah, we're in a holding pattern.
Okay. Thanks for that, Sam. We're going to take a quick break. When we're back, Sue is going to talk to us about the State Comptroller's report and cocoa plants.
I got married this Monday in the middle of a war.
You're not a soldier anymore. You're 50 years old. What is the matter with you?
It's like a couple of kilometers from here. Like, my friend has a 4x4. Let's just go cut across the fields and go get him.
Israel Stories, Wartime Diaries. Voices that try to capture slivers of life right now.
And he told me, take with you a sleeping bag and a tent and just go.
I texted him on, like, after I was told that he was killed.
From their eyes, I was a traitor.
Everybody needs their, like, blankie, their teddy bear, something to make them feel safe.
I'm just another grandfather looking after his grandchild while his son is off at war.
These children of Hamas now will be the killer of my children.
I desperately wanted to talk about sex during my eulogy for Ido.
Everyone has to choose to be optimistic because we don't have room for pessimism.
Check out Israel Story wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay. So, Sue, let's start with the report by the State Comptroller's Office released on Tuesday, castigating, really, as you wrote, several Israeli governments, several successive governments for failing to act on climate change. You know, all talk, no action. Tell us what you found.
Yeah, totally. From the environment's point of view, we have a great state controller. He brought out a major report in 2021, just before that year's climate conference, UN climate conference. And a few days ago, he published a follow-up to see what had happened with his recommendations from that 2021 report. And the bad news is twofold. The state controller has no teeth. He can't force a government to implement his recommendations. And the government has basically ignored his recommendations anyway. This government, previous governments, but the last 16 years, 15 years of them have been governed by Mr. Benjamin Netanyahu. And the state controller's words really couldn't be stronger. He said the picture was alarming and he accused the government of functional stagnation, of passing endless government decisions and then doing nothing about them. He said the key things that were missing were government attention, government leadership, a strong climate law, comprehensive government risk management and implementation of decisions. Now, we're one of very few Western countries not to have a climate law, basically because the finance and energy ministries are frightened of legal targets on emissions or on reducing emissions not being kept to. They're frightened of legal suits and all sorts of other things. And that's understandable because we were supposed to be producing 30% of our energy from renewable sources like the sun by 2030. And last year, we just about hit 10%. But on the other hand, if you don't have targets, there's not much point, or if you don't have targets set in stone, there's not much point having them at all. And in fact, today, the current government's climate bill is set to go before the Knesset. In all of its watered-down glory, there are targets. This is for first reading. There are targets, but the government can change them. And when you read the text of the bill, you see that the Environment Ministry invariably has to go hand-in-hand with the Energy and Finance Ministries on just about whatever climate steps it wants to take. Going back to the controller's report, the controller rapped the governments of recent years for failing on reducing emissions, for failing on preparing the country for climate change. And as I always remind listeners, Israel is a hot spot, which means it's warming much faster than the global average. He said none of the targets set by government decisions were going to be met and that emissions are actually on the rise. He also warned of reduced agricultural yields, food and water shortages, problems with energy supply, vulnerable a whole list of awful things that are likely to happen if government doesn't act. And the report really paints a picture of a leadership that hasn't internalised climate change, the meaning, the implications. And it's particularly critical of the finance ministry, saying that it is inactive at best and obstructive at worst. And that is certainly what we have seen on the ground. And he revealed that rather than encouraging the transition to renewable energy in any meaningful way, the government has been subsidising the fossil fuel natural gas industry by around 4 billion shekels a year, which is just over $1 billion. And that's expected to rise this year because the government has also cancelled a tax on coal. Now, according to the report, subsidies for the gas industry from 2015 to 2022 were more than 10 times more than investment approved for climate-related action and 33 times more than the amount that was actually spent. So you can put that in your pipe and smoke it, as they say.
Or hopefully not. Okay, let's find something positive with which to end this podcast. Sue, talk to us about superhero cocoa plants that even made it through the October 7th Hamas attacks.
So here is more proof that I'm not only the messenger of doom and gloom. Well, there's kind of a doom and gloom background to it. You may remember 2 or 3 weeks ago that I had a story about the olive oil shortage because of climate change.
Yep.
So it's a similar...
We spoke about it here.
So it's a similar story about cocoa. Turns out that climate change and a particular phenomenon at the moment called El Niño has wreaked absolute havoc on the main areas of cocoa growing, which today are in West Africa. We're talking about intense flooding, which encourages the growth of fungal diseases, followed by very, very high temperatures. And the result is that yields from Ivory Coast, for example, one of the biggest producers, are around a third less than usual. What's the consequence? That while prices per tonne have been stable at around $2,500 in recent years, they're now hovering around $10,000. Enter Dr. Ellen Graeber. She is a soil chemistry activist at the Volcani Centre for Plant Research, and she loves chocolate. Don't we all? And when she heard about the problems in the industry a few years ago, she started reading up and then she decided to act. She actually wanted cuttings from a specialist centre in the UK, but then Corona struck. So they sent her seeds. And with seeds, like with a mum and a dad, you never quite know what the child is going to look like. So she grew cocoa plants in the greenhouse And on October 7th, she sent a few dozen of them to a research station close to the Gaza border. 3 days later, October the 7th, Hamas invades Israel. The research station becomes part of a military zone closed to the public. And that's how it stayed until January. Now, the staff hadn't had time to connect the plants to water and fertilizer before the area was closed. So there were these plants in small pots for transport in a net house with no food and no water. When one of the researchers went back in January expecting to find a plant graveyard, she discovered that 20 plants from the same group, if you like, had not only survived, but even had new leaves. So one of the next steps will be to map these plants genetically, because it seems that they have amazing potential to withstand drought and maybe even heavy rain, because the day after the researcher discovered that they were still alive, there was a torrential rainfall. They were in this net house and the temperatures plummeted. So you'll be asking yourself whether cocoa trees can be grown in Israel. And there's been a huge amount of interest amongst Israeli farmers. Well, the answer appears to be yes. However, we are a postage stamp on the world map, and therefore we won't be able to feed chocolate to the world. But what we might be able to do is to provide the rootstock for cocoa farmers all over the world, and in that sense bring, you know, Israeli know-how and Israeli plants to save the world of chocolate.
And that would be a good thing. That would be a very good thing. Okay, all for that. I'm curious, Sue, how did you find this story?
I actually found it on Facebook. I actually found it on Facebook. There was a little video. There was a little video that the researchers from the South had posted about some of the plants that had survived.
Amazing. Okay. Social media does some good things sometimes.
Indeed.
Happy to hear it. All right, Sue and Sam, thank you so much for being with me on today's Daily Briefing. It's been good, even with the various headlines that we're all dealing with. So thank you.
Pleasure.
And thank you for listening to the Times of Israel Daily Briefing. We'll be back tomorrow with another installment. This episode was produced by the Podwaves. If you have comments about it or any others, please feel free to drop us an email at podcast@timesofisrael.com. And of course, always feel free to recommend us wherever you find your podcasts. Until next time, take care, be well, stay safe, have a good day.